Hello, and welcome to the Science Podcast for October 26, 2007. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, deep brain stimulation for Parkinson's patients, the debate and delay over delivering bed nets to Africa to prevent the spread of malaria, and the impact of agricultural soil erosion on the global carbon cycle. All this and more, plus our usual roundup of stories from our free online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, publishers of Science Magazine, advancing science and technology for the benefit of all people. The American Association for the Advancement of Science at www.aaas.org.
Learning from your mistakes and pausing to consider tough decisions are both important abilities for living daily life. In a paper published online by Science, Michael Frank and colleagues report that people with Parkinson's undergoing two specific types of treatments apparently lose one of those two abilities, depending on the treatment. Frank says that beyond the potential implications for helping treat those with Parkinson's, this research may help scientists better understand the basic mechanisms by which the brain makes decisions. I spoke with Frank from his office at the University of Arizona.
So we tested patients who were on two different kinds of treatments for Parkinson's disease, where the first kind is medication that elevates dopamine levels in their brain, and the second kind was deep brain stimulation, which is a procedure that stimulates the subthalamic nucleus, in this case, an area that's involved in Parkinson's disease, and it stimulates it in a way that's similar to what a pacemaker would be doing in the heart, but it's implanted into this small nucleus in the brain. And what we found was that the patients who were taking different kinds of medications had trouble learning from the negative outcomes of their decisions, which is a result that we found before. The novel result is that looking at these patients on deep brain stimulation, we found that it had no effect on learning from either positive or negative outcomes of decisions, but what it did is it prevented people from being able to sort of pause when you have to make a decision that's harder than some other decisions. So that's a normal thing that healthy people do and patients who are on or off medication do. They slow down when choices are hard. But these patients, when they were on deep brain stimulation, were not able to sort of adaptively slow down and be more cautious.
Now, when you say the decision was hard, what kind of decisions were these?
The task we use, a computerized decision-making task where we can actually manipulate the difficulty of the task in the lab. So it has nothing to do with sort of prepotent biases that people come into the lab with. And what we do is we give people these different symbols on a computer screen, and we ask them to just choose between these different symbols. And at the beginning, it's completely arbitrary. They have no basis for choosing between the two symbols, and they often just sort of stare at you blankly. But then they have to learn by trial and error that some of the symbols are more likely to result in positive feedback, and some of them are more likely to result in negative feedback. So over the course of learning, they should choose the ones that are more often associated with positive feedback than the ones associated with negative feedback. So this is the kind of task that sort of gauges the implicit reinforcement learning system of the brain to extract the probabilities of reinforcement. And then the pairs that we're specifically interested in, the critical pairs, happen at a test phase that occurs after the training procedure I just described, in which we give the patients and the healthy controls combinations of stimuli that they had seen before, so two symbols that they had both chosen amongst before but never together. And so a difficult decision would be choosing between two symbols that had very similar reinforcement values in the past. Like one might have been rewarding 80% of time and the other one might have been rewarding 70% of the time. That's a hard choice. It should take you a little bit longer to figure out which is the best one. Even though you're not figuring it out explicitly, you're figuring it out in an implicit sense. And so in that case, people, when they respond correctly, they choose the more optimal stimulus in some sense. They take longer to do so when compared with a low-conflict pair or a less difficult choice, which would be like choosing between 80% and 30% reward probabilities.
Okay, so you were looking at win-win situations, as it were.
Exactly. So we further divided up what we called high-conflict and low-conflict test pairs, where, as I just described, high-conflict involves choosing between two symbols that had very similar reinforcement values, but that could be two very positive reinforcement values, like win-win cases, or two negative reinforcement values, which we would refer to as lose-lose cases.
And what did you find?
Across all of the high-conflict pairs, the adaptive and healthy thing to do is to slow down, and that the patients, when they were on deep brain stimulation, they were not able to slow down across both win-win and lose-lose decisions. But when we specifically divided up into win-win separately from lose-lose, What we found was that actually in win-win decisions, the patients actually impulsively responded faster than any kind of low conflict condition. So they did, not only did they not slow down, they actually speeded their responses. Whereas in the lose-lose case, they were just unable to slow down compared to low conflict, but they didn't actually speed up.
Now, what were you comparing them to, the control or to them in a previous state without the deep brain stimulation?
So we're comparing them to their off deep brain stimulation state, so the same patient when they're not on deep brain stimulation. So providing a within subject control allows us to control for all sorts of other factors that you might imagine affect decision making, like just having the disease or a different state of the disease or other kinds of factors. So it's actually the same person that we can manipulate both on and off deep brain stimulation.
Did you find anything else?
Patients who were off deep brain stimulation were able to slow down, as I mentioned. But then what we did to provide an additional test of the hypothesis was we then turned them on deep brain stimulation after having learned the task and after having gone through the initial test phase, and then tested them again just 10 minutes later. So then we were able to show that once you turn them on deep brain stimulation after having showed the normal sort of conflict-induced slowing, as it were, they now are significantly faster at the high conflict pairs again in the second test phase, showing that it's not an effect of deep brain stimulation on any other aspect of the task, on the learning or other kinds of functions, but it's really an effect of the experienced conflict. Now, we think that they actually are still experiencing conflict in essentially a different part of their brain, which is in the frontal cortex, the anterior cingulate cortex to be more specific, but they're just not able to use this conflict-related activity to actually slow down or to be more cautious in their behavior, because to do that, we think that the subthalamic nucleus is critical for implementing this kind of cognitive control.
And this is what's being stimulated by the deep brain stimulator?
Right. The deep brain stimulator is implanted directly in the subthalamic nucleus.
Just wanted to be sure about that. Now, are there any examples of what somebody might do if they are on deep brain stimulation and making these choices impulsively?
Sure. So one of the reasons we did the study was it's been documented several times anecdotally and a few times in the laboratory that although deep brain stimulation is really beneficial for improving the motor symptoms of Parkinson's disease, it actually causes negative effects on cognition and in some cases can induce impulsive decision making. And you can notice that in patients, they often will be very disinhibited, as it were, so they will talk very fast or they would say things that they would not normally say. And one of the examples that we saw in the very first patient that was in our study was a patient who sat down in front of the computer to do the experiment. And I looked at the chair he was sitting in, and he didn't seem very comfortable. So I pointed to a chair that was on the other side of the room, and I suggested that maybe that other chair might be more comfortable for him. Now, this was a patient who was ill and was in a wheelchair. And although he was fairly sharp mentally, he was talking very fast, and he had been a very successful scientist with a lot of grant money and everything. He immediately looked at the chair across the room, and he couldn't walk, but he nevertheless got up and started darting toward that chair to his wife's horror. And we were able to stop him, prevent him from falling. And we think that's the kind of an example where sort of the prospect of the more comfortable chair on the other side of the room, which is rewarding in some sense, it's something that he desired, drove him to approach that chair. And he was not able to sort of pause and say, well, this is a situation that I probably shouldn't do because I'm not in the state that allows me to walk properly without some help.
Does this have any implications for people without Parkinson's?
Even just, I think this mechanism, besides having potential implications for Parkinson's disease, helps us to try to understand just the basic mechanisms by which the brain makes decisions.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay.
Michael Frank is lead author of a paper on the effects of deep brain stimulation on people with Parkinson's. Read the paper online at www.scienceexpress.org and a related news article in this week's Science. The issue also includes a special section on neuroscience. Other brain research in this week's Science, the origins of drug craving behavior. Marco Contreras and colleagues have identified the insular cortex as the region of the brain in rats that plays a role in craving amphetamines. By reversibly silencing all signals to the insula, the researchers found that the rats stopped craving the drugs. This silencing also disrupted the malaise and gastrointestinal discomfort that researchers induced in rats by injecting them with lithium chloride, which is similar in its side effects to the lithium drugs people use for mood stabilization. If these findings in rats prove applicable to humans, they may lead to therapies to treat drug addiction and reduce the side effects from medications. Read the paper, Inactivation of the Interoceptive Insula Disrupts Drug Craving and Malaise Induced by Lithium, in this week's Science. Bed nets. Jeffrey Sachs famously argued this past June that providing one bed net for every sleeping space in Africa could slash malaria transmission there by 90%. The disease, transmitted by parasites and spread by mosquito bites, kills an estimated 1 million Africans each year. In this week's Science, Deputy News Editor Leslie Roberts reports on the debate and delay over how best to deliver bed nets to Africa.
Everybody agrees bed nets work and you should get them out, but there are very different views on whether everyone should get one for free and can the world really pay for that, versus other people who are a little more cautious and worry that donors will make commitments and then the bed nets will disappear.
How would they disappear? Where would they go?
Well, even now with the long-lasting bed nets, they need to be replaced every 5 years. And so the concern that some people have is that if the world commits to this wonderfully ambitious scheme that Jeff Sachs has proposed to give a bed net to cover every sleeping space in Africa, that 5 or 10 years from now, the donors won't be interested in malaria anymore and nobody will repeat it. And then bed net coverage will actually have dropped and people might be more vulnerable to malaria.
So it's not a function of the bed nets disappearing into, say, the hands of gorillas or other people?
No, they disappear in that they tear, they rip, new kids are born. So there's a mass campaign to give, there are in several countries like Zambia now, is trying to give bed nets to 80% of the population by the end of next year. But then they worry about what's the keep-up strategy 5 years from now, or what happens to the kids who are born 3 years from now.
Why would malaria come back even worse if there weren't new bed nets after 5 or 10 years?
Since malaria is endemic across Africa, many people have immunity to the disease. That's why children are the most likely to die, children under age 5. And adults have been exposed to malaria so much, to the malaria parasite, that they might get sick, but they're unlikely to die. But if, let's say, the continent were blanketed in bed nets, and then this would lead to what they hope is something called a community effect, which means it actually reduces the population of the mosquitoes that carried the parasite. So people who would ordinarily have built up immunity from exposure to malaria would no longer have immunity, so they could actually be more at risk when they were exposed.
Now, is malaria going to stick around even if after 5 years everybody did have a bed net?
Yes, yes. There was just a very grand plan. Bill and Melinda Gates just called for eradicating malaria at a meeting last week in Seattle. But even they won't put a time frame on it. And the world had tried to eradicate malaria before in the 50s, and it failed miserably, and malaria came back worse. So most people think it won't go away. But people are optimistic that if everybody has a bed net, you might get malaria transmission down by 90%. So you wouldn't get rid of it, but it would not be this huge public health problem it is today.
Now, is the reason that it wouldn't go away, say, in the life period times of several generations of mosquitoes, is because it's sticking around in people and those who have it will continue to have it, so when they're bit by a mosquito, they might start it all back up again?
Right. It goes from the mosquito to a person and then back. The infected mosquito will transmit both ways, will infect a person and then carry it on to somebody else. But then it's very hard to eradicate any disease. Only smallpox has ever been eradicated, and people are struggling now to try to eradicate polio. And that's a very simple disease that is just caused by a virus that infects people and not animals, where in this case you have a parasite that is in a mosquito that is biting people. So it's a much more complicated lifestyle, and it's hard to know where to attack it.
Now, are bed nets really the best prevention method? Might there be something else that would work better or equally as well?
There is no vaccine, so people have come to realize that bed nets are what they call the de facto vaccine against malaria. That they've been around forever, but the data on how well the insecticide-treated nets work has only really come out in the past since 2000, there were a series of big clinical trials, and they're showing that they have an astounding effect if they're used widely, that malaria can drop 44%, let's say, just with the numbers coming out of Kenya recently.
So there really isn't any substitute then for bed nets in terms of effectiveness.
Right. And they are cheap by our standards. I mean, it's a long-lasting bed net that will last 5 years, costs about $5. But that's not cheap to somebody who's living on less than a dollar a day.
Right, right. Now, how much money are we talking about here to put a bed net on every bed in Africa?
It's hard to get an exact figure. I know Jeff Sachs has said that you can do it for 60 cents a net per person per year. But when I've asked him for an overall dollar amount, what I get is he says it'll be $3 billion a year to provide bed nets and access to drugs. And it's hard to tease out the bed net because 1.7 people sleep under a bed net and they last for 5 years and they divide all these things. So I don't have a cost just for the bed nets.
Okay. So is any of the conflict over how to distribute the bed nets coming from people on the ground in Africa, or is it just these big thinkers?
No, it is very much people on the ground who say they applaud these grand ideas. And one of the researchers I talked to said, who could ever be opposed to this? This is wonderful. Everyone should have a bed net. But the practical realities of getting them out to everyone are huge. The people on the ground are worried that it sounds simple, but it's really not.
Where is the resistance coming from in believing that these big donors will be able to donate again and again?
I think it's in ministries of health in Africa. It's in researchers on the ground in Africa who have seen ambitious programs come and go. And what they're concerned about is what they call sustainability. They want to get bed nets to everybody, but then make sure that they continue to get them. And that's really what they're worried about, is the follow through.
So even though groups like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation that have promised to end malaria are committed, they're concerned that, well, that foundation may not be around forever or may not be committed for the time that it would take.
Right. I spoke with someone in the Tanzanian Ministry of Health who said to have universal free bed net coverage, he was estimating would cost $200 million a year, and that is 3/4 of his budget at the Ministry of Health, and saying that they simply don't have the money to do that. And Jeff Sachs has then said he has personally promised to raise the money for them.
But not necessarily every year or every 5 or 10 or 15 years.
That's what they're concerned about.
What's the bottom line here?
I guess the bottom line is it's all for the good, I guess, this debate. I'm not sure quite how to say it, but, you know, everybody's on the side of right. But however this is resolved, if people decide to give bed nets to 80% of the population or 70%, Africa's going to be a lot better off. There's going to be a lot less malaria. So in a way, it's the growing pains of all the new global concern for malaria and all the new money.
Science Deputy News Editor Leslie Roberts reports on the intense debate over how best to deliver bed nets to Africa. Read the article in this week's Science. Also in this week's Science, a cold spot in the universe. Marcos Cruz and colleagues report finding an unusual spot in the cosmic microwave background. This microwave background is the oldest radiation measured in the universe and is thought to have come from the Big Bang. Awaiting confirmation, the result may provide cosmologists with a long-sought clue about how the early universe formed, in particular, as a cosmic texture. Read more about it online at www.scienceexpress.org. What are the sources and sinks for carbon in the global carbon cycle? It's an important question for policymakers in trying to determine policies needed to curb global climate change. Soil erosion previously had been thought either to be a big carbon source or a big carbon sink. But in this week's Science, Timothy Quine and colleagues report that agricultural soil erosion is actually, overall, a small sink for carbon, sequestering just under 2% of the amount of carbon currently released from fossil fuel emissions. I spoke with Quine from his office at the University of Exeter in the United Kingdom.
Agricultural soil erosion is recognized as an important economic impact on agricultural quality, but only recently we identified its significance for the global carbon cycle. There are ranging estimates of the influence of agricultural erosion on the carbon cycle from a 1 petagram sink to a 1 petagram source. And it's not really just an academic debate to try and solve the problem as to which is represented. So our paper is really trying to address this debate and come up with perhaps a more realistic estimate of the magnitude of this influence on the global carbon cycle.
How much is a petagram? What are we talking about here in terms of amount?
1 petagram is approximately, was equal to 1 gigaton, which is approximately 15% of current global fossil fuel emissions.
Quite a difference then, if it's a sink or a source. So how is it that soil is a source or a sink for carbon emissions?
There are three different mechanisms going on here. So at sites of erosion, we can imagine that we export carbon out of the location of erosion, so there's less remaining carbon available for decomposition. So we might anticipate that by eroding carbon, we might reduce the rate at which carbon is being decomposed from the soil. And at the same time, plants that continue to grow at sites of erosion will contribute carbon into the soil and contribute to the replenishment of the carbon stocks. Whereas at sites of deposition, the addition of sediment and soil at the surface may lead to the gradual burial of carbon below the surface. And as we move carbon down the soil profile, we move it from the area of most microbial activity to area with rather less microbial activity. And we might anticipate that this will lead to a lowering of decomposition rates. So we have these two components which we may anticipate would drive a sink of carbon. On the other hand, as we erode soil across the landscape, it tends to get disaggregated, and that may accelerate rates of decomposition, and that's the principal proposed mechanism for driving a source of atmospheric carbon dioxide.
You were trying to resolve the question of whether it was 1 petagram of carbon more or 1 petagram of carbon less because of agricultural activities. How did you test your hypothesis?
We started from the perspective of looking at a retrospective assessment of how much carbon had been exchanged with the atmosphere at sites of erosion and deposition over the last half century. And we did this by measuring the artificial radionuclide cesium-137, which was deposited as a byproduct of nuclear weapons testing during the third quarter of the last century. And we used that to simulate the carbon inventories of soil profiles subject to erosion, but with no net exchange of carbon with the atmosphere. We then compared the simulated carbon inventories, in which we assume no net exchange with the atmosphere, with measured carbon inventories for 1,400 soil profiles from 14 watersheds. And we use the deviation between the simulated and measured carbon inventories to identify the direction and the magnitude of the fluxes of carbon between the soil and the atmosphere.
And what did you find?
Yeah, our conclusion is that approximately 26% of the carbon that's eroded from sites of erosion and deposited within agricultural fields, about 26% of this eroded carbon is replaced at the sites of erosion. And this provides us with a sink which at the field scale is of the order of 1 to 6 grams of carbon per square meter per year. And when we sum this up across the globe, we end up with a sink of the order of 0.12 petagrams of carbon per year. So approximately a tenth of the size of sinks that have been identified before. We're so clearly not seeing a source of carbon, but we are seeing what we think is a sink of carbon.
Why is that estimate so much lower?
There are two reasons here, really. One is that past estimates have tended to assume that all the eroded carbon found in depositional areas has been replaced by new carbon on the slopes, whereas for our sites we find this figure of around about 26% of the carbon being replaced. And so clearly this lack of complete replacement of carbon limits the size of the sink that could be associated with erosion and deposition. And the second reason we think we have a lower estimate of the size of the sink is that we've estimated rather lower rates of soil erosion on agricultural land, reflecting what we believe are improvements in the modeling of erosion rates.
So not very much impact then?
No, so we have what appears to be a much smaller sink, but a sink nevertheless.
What are the implications of this?
has rather significant implications about the way we derive policy for agricultural land. If we had had a large sink of the order of petagrams sink associated with erosion, we would need to have borne that in mind in any attempts to offset carbon emissions through strategies to reduce soil erosion rates. As we see a much smaller sink estimate, then it doesn't have the same need to offset this loss of the sink if we look for erosion control measures. On the other hand, the fact that we haven't found a one petagram source means that we can't use erosion control as a means of setting fossil fuel emissions, because we're not switching off a major source of carbon to the atmosphere, we're switching off a small sink if we control accelerated erosion.
I imagine that makes the farmers quite happy. They're not going to have to change their policies.
I think it means that there will still be a drive to control erosion and probably a drive for strategies such as no-till for the benefits they have for soil quality. But I think the take-home message is we mustn't try and use erosion control as a way of excusing ourselves from reducing our fossil fuel emissions.
Because the 0.1 petagrams is still about, as you said before, about 1.5% of the global carbon emissions, is that right?
That's right, yeah, about 1.5% of global fossil fuel emissions.
Now, this method that you chose to use, is this a pretty standard practice with this degradation of cesium-137?
Yes, cesium-137 has been used quite widely in erosion assessments, but this is the first time it's been used to undertake this retrospective assessment of carbon fluxes with the atmosphere at this scale. It's a technique that we've only just developed.
So what's next then?
I think in the future direction we need to take is to get a much better handle on this limit on replacement of carbon at sites of erosion. While we've had a widely distributed data set from these 14 watersheds, they are principally derived from systems where mechanical agriculture is employed and with relatively high inputs. We're yet to really establish what happens in low input systems, which obviously represent a large proportion of the agricultural area of the earth. And it may be that in these environments we get an even lower rate of carbon return to the soil due to impacts on crop production. I think we also need to think about coupling up our work with climate modelling work to see what we think may happen to this store of carbon that's existing in agricultural landscapes and what the future prospects for that are under the gradually changing climate of the next half century.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Timothy Quine is lead co-author of a paper on the impact of agricultural soil erosion on the global carbon cycle. Read more about it in this week's Science. Finally today, David Grimm, editor of Science's free online daily news site, Science Now, is here to talk to us about the latest science stories. David, what do you got for us today?
Rob, I've got three cool stories for you. We're going to talk about sunscreen made from broccoli, why the flu hits us hardest in the winter, and finally, how elephants, based on their scent, tell friend from foe.
Sunscreen made from broccoli? Are you going to, what, rub broccoli up against your skin?
Not exactly, but not too far from the truth. What this study concerns is the UV radiation that we all experience when we get sun damage. And when the sun strikes our skin, it releases harmful oxidizing agents, which our body has to combat. And our body has natural systems to deal with this, but UV radiation, for some reason, doesn't really kick these systems into high gear. So scientists have been trying to figure out, is there a chemical we can put on people's skin that will give them more protection against oxidative damage?
And they found that in broccoli?
They found it in broccoli. There is a chemical from broccoli extracts known as sulforaphane. And previous studies have shown that sulforaphane seemed to reduce the inflammation caused by UV damage, which indicates that it may have some properties in combating this damage, but scientists weren't sure. So they rounded up a few volunteers, and they looked at their backs, and on their backs, they either applied some broccoli extract or nothing at all, and then exposed the backs to various amounts of UV light. So what they found was that people that the areas of the backs that had the broccoli extract on them had 37% less cell damage.
Now, how do they measure cell damage?
Basically by looking at the redness of the skin. So the redder the skin, the more cell damage, and they saw less redness in the areas of the back where the people had applied the broccoli extract.
How does this differ from regular sunscreen, or is this a sunscreen?
No, it's not a sunscreen in itself because it's not preventing UV rays from striking your body like sunscreen does. It's preventing the damage that the rays cause. So it's, you can imagine it would be a complement to sunscreen rather than a substitute for sunscreen.
Are there any other potential applications for this?
Well, some experts think that they might be able to use this extract or sulforaphane for chemo prevention.
Well, what's that mean?
Well, when some patients are on immunosuppressive drugs, they actually have a heightened risk of skin cancer. So one could imagine that if they were to apply this compound, that risk might go down.
Okay. Well, from preventing cancer from those getting too much sun to preventing influenza from those of us here in the Northern Hemisphere where it's getting to be winter. Why is fall and winter the time for influenza?
Great question to be asking with flu season almost upon us. And the U.S. Centers for Disease Control have noticed that there's always seems to be a spike in flu cases in the winter, what we call our flu season. But they don't really know why. Some people think it's because we spend more time indoors or more time in close quarters with other people, so the virus is being transmitted easier. And other people think that it's just because somehow our immune systems are getting weaker in the winter and we're more susceptible to flu. But there's really no proof. Really strong evidence for either of these.
So what do the researchers do?
So the researchers used the age-old laboratory animal, the guinea pig. And what they did was they took a few guinea pigs, infected them with human flu, and put them in cages next to guinea pigs that didn't have the flu. And then they altered the temperature and humidity of the room. And what they found was that at high temperatures and high humidities, the flu didn't spread between the guinea pigs. So when the temperature rose above 30 degrees Celsius or the humidity rose above 80%, the healthy guinea pigs didn't contract flu from the infected guinea pigs.
Is that because the sneezes of the guinea pigs just didn't transmit as far under those conditions? Or was there something about the virus itself under those conditions?
They think it's something about the virus itself. The virus seemed to be transmitted much more easily when the temperature in the room was cold and the humidity was very low, much as like what you would see in winter. And the researchers think there's something about those conditions that just make the virus more stable. So maybe it lasts longer in the air, lasts longer in the skin, or in the mucous membranes. But they think it's actually affecting, the conditions are actually affecting the virus itself.
So are researchers going to be able to use this information in clinical settings like hospitals? I'd hate to go to a hot, sticky, wet hospital.
Well, it's a good question. Somebody had suggested, well, maybe in nursing homes where there's a big problem with flu transmission, then flu can be very dangerous for elderly people. Just, hey, crank up the humidity and crank up the heat. But it's not a clear-cut solution because the problem is when you do that, you can foster the growth of other pathogens such as mold and bacteria. So you could be trading one problem for another.
Well, from avoiding the sniffles to using them as protection in elephants. What are these elephants doing sniffing people?
The elephants are sniffing people because they're trying to tell their friend from their enemy. And this has to do with two tribes in Africa, the Maasai tribe, which is more of a hunting tribe, and the Kamba tribe, which is more of a farmer tribe. And researchers have noticed that the elephants take much more kindly to the Kamba tribe than they do to the Maasai tribe. And there's probably good reason for that. Young Maasai warriors, as a rite of passage, spear elephants. So they're not too kind to their elephant neighbors, whereas the farmers pretty much leave the elephants alone. But the elephants really seemed to know the difference between the two tribes. But researchers didn't know how the elephants were able to tell people from the farming tribe from the hunting tribe.
So what did they test?
So what they did was they gave individuals of both tribes these bright red clothes to wear. And the reason they chose bright red clothes is because that's the type of clothing the Maasai tribe used for 5 days till the clothes got nice and stinky. And then they put the clothes upwind from the elephants. So the elephants actually couldn't see the clothes. They couldn't see the colors, but they could smell them. And when the elephants smelled the clothes that the hunters had worn, they reacted much differently than when they smelled the clothes that the farmers had worn. They got very agitated. They distanced themselves about 65% farther from the hunter clothes than from the farmer clothes, and they moved away about 27% faster.
Now, what was the smell that was the difference? Was it that they had gotten blood on the clothes, or the people just actually smelled differently?
They don't know, but apparently there's something different about the way that the hunters smell from the way the farmers smell. Maybe it's the chores they do in daily life or their diet or something like that, but it's something the elephants can clearly pick up on.
So the smell made a difference. Did the red color matter?
Yes, and that's something they wanted to test because the hunters typically wear that color, but the farmers tend to wear lighter colors. So the researchers wanted to see if color played a role too. So what they did was, instead of doing the smell test this time, they took unscented red clothes and white clothes, and they put them close to the elephants. And this time, they noticed the elephants acted very aggressively towards the red clothes, and not as aggressively towards the white clothes.
Now, that's a bit counterintuitive. Wouldn't they run away like they did before?
You would think they would run away, but the problem is that elephants don't have very good sense of sight. So they really didn't sense the difference until the clothes were very close to them. And at that point, running is not really an option. It's more of an aggressive option, and one would imagine they'd want to be more aggressive towards the hunters who might be about to spear them than the farmers that are going to leave them alone.
Well, we've always known that elephants have a good memory.
And now we know for sure that memory is both sight and smell.
Okay, Dave, well, thanks very much. What's coming up later this week on Science Now?
We've got some cool stories coming up, Rob. We'll be writing about identifying the brain region responsible for optimism, changing the sexual orientation of worms, and finally, solving the mystery of Sirius, the brightest star in the sky. You'll have to check the site to see what the mystery is, first of all, and how they solved it.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the free online daily news service of science. You can catch up with the latest science stories at sciencenow.sciencemag.org. And that wraps up the October 26, 2007 Science Podcast. The show is a production of Science Magazine and of AAAS, the Science Society, with additional financial support from the Golden Fund. The content is provided by the news and editorial staff of Science, and Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.